Hello and welcome to Outward for the month of October. I'm Christina Cotarucci, a staff writer at Slate and host of The Waves, Slate's podcast about women and gender. And I am a big juicy ball of adolescent emotion this month because I've been listening to the new Tegan and Sarah album. I'm crying inside.
I'm Brian Lauder, editor of Outward, and I just parallel parked under duress yesterday for the first time in 12 years in New fucking York.
Wow.
So I need to hold space for that achievement just for a minute here on the podcast.
Snaps for you.
Snaps for me. Thank you. Thank you.
Pretty Ricky is what they call me, and I'm here guest hosting and trying to figure out why people think Lizzo is a rapper.
Ooh, we could do a whole episode about that.
We could.
I'm so flummoxed by that.
People been saying that?
Yeah, that she's categorized as a rapper, and I'm like, yeah, her words rhyme, but doesn't every musician's words rhyme? So what? Okay.
Huh. Interesting.
So, listeners, you might recognize Ricky from our episode on icons. He came on to talk about drag kinging, show production, icons of masculinity, and the subversion thereof. And we're so happy to have him back in the studio today to guest host. We have a really good show planned for today. Plenty of tasty topics on the docket. For one, we're going to be talking about the LGBTQ town hall that the Democratic presidential candidates participated in. We're recording this just mere hours after the town hall wrapped up, so we'll discuss that. We're also going to talk about the new gender-neutral doll for children from Mattel. We've got a couple examples of the dolls here in the studio, and we're going to have fun playing with them. But first, Brian, take us into our intro segment.
Yeah, we have Pride and Provocations, just like every episode. And so I was wondering, Ricky, if you would like to start us off. Do you have a Pride or Provocation this month?
I guess I kind of already did that when I talked about Lizzo, but...
You're allowed to be provoked multiple times.
I am provoked by that multiple times. Pride definitely in seeing how much LGBTQ representation we're starting to see on television right now. The new Batwoman show is coming out starring Ruby Rose, who has definitely become a queer icon. I'm also a big fan of Black Lightning, also a superhero show featuring a black lesbian superhero. So take that, all of you racists out there. She's black and she can kick your butt. So... that's my pride.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Christina. I've got a provocation this month. So by the time this show airs, it'll be maybe a week or so since this was really a hot topic, but a lot of people have been talking about it this month, so I wanted to address it. I'm talking about Ellen DeGeneres, who was photographed having a little LOL with George W. Bush at a Dallas Cowboys game. That's football, for anyone unaware.
Thank you.
Sure, yeah, that was for you, Brian. She got some criticism for it, so she did a little segment on her show to defend herself because people are like, you know, hey, why are you hanging out with this war criminal and noted homophobe? And she said in her segment, I'm friends with George Bush. I try to teach you on this show to be kind to everybody, not only the people you agree with. For example, I'm friends with people who wear fur, and I don't agree with wearing fur, but we're still friends. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion these days about cancel culture and civility and, being able to accept people with different perspectives. And I think some people are starting to realize that political positions or even party affiliation aren't necessarily indicators of benign differences of opinions. You know, they carry the weight of lives and livelihoods, their flesh and blood, their pain. They touch on the deepest questions of morality and decency. And when we talk about, we're not talking about kindness and unkindness. I think about my little niece who's three, who has recently learned the word kind and what it means to be kind. And, you know, my sister is doing a great job teaching her about how to treat other people. But we're not talking about kindness here. Like, the reason why people don't like George Bush is not because he's unkind or they're not being unkind to him when they don't when they criticize a public figure for giving him her stamp of approval. We're talking about justice and injustice. It's not about kids sharing on the playground. This is a person with political power wielding that power to harm and vilify and oppress. And then another person, Ellen, with cultural capital, using that capital to paint over those injustices that he's perpetrated. And I think the people who are moved to defend Ellen DeGeneres or George Bush are trying to say, like, can't we get along? There's all these, like, you know, rifts in the political landscape right now. And I wonder what kind of person you have to be, how – I wonder how out of touch you have to be from members of your own community, or how thoroughly, like, your own wealth must insulate you from the threat of discrimination in order to enjoy a football game with the man who – literally tried to change the U.S. Constitution to explicitly shame you into second-class citizenship, just to put aside all of the actual war crimes that he, you know, committed or and tried to paper over in his administration. I just wonder. So that's what I've been provoked by this month.
Are we allowed to make commentary on that? Because first off,
yeah.
I want to
yeah.
give
Please.
Hallelujah hands to to everything that you just said.
Same.
This idea that we have to put our humanities aside so that we can be nice to each other. Racists aren't necessarily mean, toothless, you know, suspender wearing dudes in some swamp somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. They can be your neighbor, your boss, your coworker, right?
Totally and respectable.
They can be respectable and they can be kind and they can be funny, but that doesn't mean that I have to somehow put aside your racist, homophobic viewpoints to what? So that we can share coffee? First off, I don't want coffee with
There's
you.
There's plenty of other people to have coffee with.
Right? I have other people in my life to have coffee with who don't think that I'm a second-class citizen. So no thank you to that. And all the props to you for bringing that up, because that has been quite a thing. And I think this idea that people can still sit in the middle on things like this, it makes me angry. You are not allowed to be in the middle on this. There's no... You know, at what point are children in cages kind of okay, right? Where's your middle ground on that? There is no middle ground on that. So let's stop with this. We have to be nice to one another. I can still be nice to you and also tell you that you're a terrible human being. So.
Word.
Yeah.
Brian, how are you feeling this month?
I loved all that. So I am feeling pride actually about a TV show as well. Over on Netflix, I don't know if y'all watch Big Mouth at all, which is the
masturbation show.
it's a show about puberty.
I know.
I
have watched a couple episodes and I think it was like a little bit much for me.
It's a lot.
I was
it's
the
a lot.
Child who was like too prude for Ren and Stimpy. So
yeah, it's a lot. For our listeners who haven't seen it necessarily, it's a sort of middle school age characters, obviously written with much more adult sensibilities, cartoon about puberty. There's like a hormone monster for everybody. It's great. It's really funny and smart. This season, which just dropped, I think maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, has a lot more queerness in it, especially around bi and pansexuality, which has been really exciting. In past seasons, there's been a gay character, Matthew, and he's getting a little bit more play in this season with a boyfriend and things like that. But really, the focus is on the non-monosexuals in the school. Jay is a cis guy who has lots of funny aspects to his character, but he's bi, and that's been like a huge and increasingly big focus of the show and how he's navigating that. And then late in the season, there's an episode where a pan character moves to the school, and she's a girl, and that episode is a lot about how non-monosexuality is treated differently in men and women, which is really smartly done. Yeah. I just highly recommend it. It's smart. It's very funny. And I think it's a show that really gives the lie to this like dumb comedian discourse right now that says that, you know, there's nothing that can be transgressive in comedy anymore. The show is, as you pointed out, Christina, like extremely transgressive in many ways, but is super smart and I think socially responsible and progressive. So highly recommend the new season of Big Mouth. Very proud of it.
It sounds really good.
Thanks.
I couldn't watch it. There were too many penises in it for me.
there's all kinds of body parts.
Yeah, it's like all like, over this the place. I only saw the first episode where the penises were playing basketball, and yeah. I was like, I don't know this is a show for me.
Yeah,
it was a little bit much.
That's very fair. The new Star series Marianne George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. You've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. The show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Marianne George now, only on Stars and the Stars app.
Okay, on that note, our first topic for today, the presidential town hall on LGBTQ issues. It aired on CNN on October 10th. It was co-organized by the HRC. Bernie Sanders couldn't make it because of his recent heart attack, but all the other usual suspects were there, plus a couple unusual suspects, like Tom Steyer, who's a bajillionaire who is now made it to the Democratic debate stage. But his segment aired really late at night, and we'll mostly be talking about the more viable candidates who were up on stage. So the point of this town hall, as far as I saw it, was not necessarily to show that they were all like on the right side of the issues, so to speak. I mean, there were a few substantive differences between some of the candidates on sex work, on talking about the tax-exempt status of religious organizations that discriminate. But I'm going to play a little clip from Joe Biden explaining what the actual point of the debate was in his view.
And by the way, I suspect, Dennis, you're going to hear this is going to be one forum where you're going to very little disagreement among the Democratic candidates. Mm. I'm proud of the position they all have because every one of us are. If there's differences, they're just in degree and emotional concern.
So I'm not sure if I would quite explain it that way, that it was about degree of emotional concern. But I will say I saw it more as an opportunity for candidates to show how fluent they were. So watching the town hall, it seemed to me like a real collision of timelines, like in the way that, you know, Joe Biden, to quote him again, he's so quotable. He was like, you know, you could get married on Saturday and fired on Tuesday. I think that's an extremely stupid way to talk about the state of LGBTQ rights, but not stupid. It's a little bit reductive, but I think it does explain how a lot of people who aren't necessarily living LGBTQ lives day to day see things. They're like, wow, you know, look how far the public has come, even on acceptance of gay marriage. And, you know, gay marriage, the Defense of Marriage Act was still around when the last major forum on LGBTQ rights happened in 2007, where like almost none of the candidates running for president even said gay marriage was a thing that they could support. But then even watching the town hall last night, there were some moments that struck me as incredibly not progressive. And it was like they were all coming together in this one space. You know, Kamala Harris coming out and saying, my pronouns are she, her, and hers. And then Chris Cuomo coming out and saying, mine too. Like, it was a moment where I felt like she was in like the most minor way trying to say, like, I understand the language that you guys use. And then the moderator treating it as a joke. You guys think about the town hall?
That was such a cringeworthy moment. Already, like, I know that we're going to probably start talking a little bit about how we feel about the candidates in general as prospective, front runners. But This is a problem I have with Kamala Harris. She seems like an aunt who's out of touch, who's trying to use words to connect with you. She's like, everything's lit, isn't it? And you're like, sure, Auntie Kamala, it's very lit. And just watching her talk, it feels like she's just missing something to connect with an audience. So even if she did have good points, I was oftentimes just kind of turned off by her presentation on stage in general. And as a Black woman, I would like to root for the only Black woman who's running for president. But, you know, we all have issues with her in general. But cringeworthy moment for sure. But if we talk about how they handled the protesters, I would actually say that they did a really good job of letting people say the things that they wanted to say. I am forgetting her name. She was the one that interacted with Don Lemon.
Blossom.
Yes. Yeah. I thought he did a fairly decent job of letting Blossom talk. And at one point, he did take the mic from her, but then he gave it back to her.
Yeah.
So it's a hard thing to do, especially on the spot, live in front of a bunch of people. But for the most part, I thought they did a fairly decent job letting protesters speak and reiterating the things that they were trying to say as for the audience that was there and the audience that was watching at home.
Yeah. I was really impressed by that, too. I mean, I think we've seen protests at other debates and events like this, and it's just the way it was handled here was by and large, like, refreshing. So that was definitely a positive thing. Amid all the gay bathhouse cringe moments, referencing another one that Biden made. Yeah.
Before we get into that, which I think is we should definitely talk about, I will say the two major moments where protesters sort of came to the front and everyone had to pause to take in what they were saying. And it was, you know, about Black trans people not having a voice at the debate. And I think after Blossom spoke and said that, there were at least a couple of Black trans people who did get to speak. But at the time, she was like, you know, this is anti-Blackness. You're only letting, you know, non-Black people of color who are trans ask the questions. But I was like exhilarated by those moments. I don't think I've ever seen that happen at a presidential debate where protesters have stood up to say something and they've actually been given the chance to be heard.
Yeah.
It felt like a total power shift. And this actually explains kind of how I watched the rest of the debate too. It felt like a shift in power from the usual way that these events are conducted. It speaks to the power that LGBTQ people have demanded for themselves, where, you know, we were able to have this entire town hall where candidates weren't just pandering to us, but recognizing that that we have a lot of things to teach them.
Yeah, to that point, I feel like I was most maybe surprised or impressed by Cory Booker on that point. I was not, and to be, you know, my beat is not politics, so I'm not like in this every day like Christina might be, but I hadn't heard him speak on these issues before, and I found him to be almost, maybe beside Warren, like the most sort of conversant and comfortable. He felt like, if comfort is a metric we're using, which I think is a good one, he just like seemed to really get it. And I was really won over just by his sort of handling of the various, you know, questions that each candidate got sort of the same questions phrased slightly differently. I mean, he handled, I think, all of them pretty well, but also his ability to kind of pivot from the direct question into like larger issues too, about healthcare and about other things like that. It was striking to see that happen from him. So I really enjoyed that experience for sure.
I want to talk to you guys about this moment that Elizabeth Warren has been getting a lot of praise for. She made a joke sort of mocking homophobes. So someone in the audience asked her, what would you say to somebody on the campaign trail who said, I'm traditional, and because of my faith, I think marriage is only between one man and one woman? And she said, I'm going to assume it's a guy, or, you know, for the sake of argument. Mm-hmm. And I would say, just marry one woman then. And then everyone laughed and clapped. And then she goes, assuming you can find one. And yeah. Oh, my God, did everyone just erupt in praise for her. I got a chuckle out of it, but I actually feel a little bit uncomfortable with that. I mean, first of all, I don't think that's true. Like, women marry homophobes all the time and are homophobic. And, you know, you're like, I felt like she was sort of implying that homophobic views are so beyond the pale that somebody will be socially ostracized if they have them, which, you know, Joe Biden said something similar. I just don't think that's where America is right now. There are homophobes everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it felt good in the moment. It felt, and a lot of the town hall felt like this, where there was sort of a looser vibe, I think, because LGBTQ people are so much fun. The candidates felt like they could joke a little more. There was a little bit, it didn't feel as sort of staid as a typical debate. I just picture a lot of people on the right taking that clip and playing it to people. And, you know, even some people who are like, yes, I support gay rights, will look at that and think, like, how rude do you have to be to mock a hypothetical constituent? But I guess it just goes to show what the town hall was, which is, like, making statements of values within a community, not making persuasive arguments outside of it. How did you guys feel about that moment?
If I can, I didn't actually have an issue with what she said. I see your viewpoint 100%. But that was a moment that she showed personality that mm-hmm. I think a lot of the other candidates struggle with. And whether what she said was appropriate or not, it showed a fieriness in her that we need right now. And we need somebody who is willing to make very, strong, opinionated stances on things. And whether her stance is right or wrong, we can definitely debate that. But that was the moment that I was like, yeah, I mess with Elizabeth Warren. Like, she was it was the thing that kind of won me over. I was already like leaning towards her. But for me, that was the thing that kind of won me over for her. And I get what you're saying. 100% the right side will 100%. But regardless of what she said, they were going to twist it anyway. So might as well have a little bit of fun with it.
I guess she's also saying, like, I'm not an Ellen DeGeneres. Like, I don't suffer fools.
Yeah. And I liked that about her. And the fact that she stated it so plainly, I think, was also like the first part of her little quote unquote joke. Right. The second part, again, we can talk about that. Probably for a few hours. But the first part of what she said, then just marry one woman, for me was like so simplistic and profound. Mm-hmm. Like, then just marry one woman. Like, if that's what you feel, then you do your thing and we'll do our thing. And they don't have to meet in the middle in any way, shape, or form. What you do doesn't have to do anything with what I do. So
I think it was sort of a good corrective to this line that Biden was sort of espousing a lot, which was like, the people just don't know. Americans just don't know. They don't understand it. You know, like, homophobes just need to be, like, educated, which I feel like is a very, I hate to say it, but just, like, older person kind of, like, mm-hmm. way of thinking about this stuff. And, like, and I agree, Ricky, that we're, like, past that. Like, I want a candidate who is not fucking around with that kind of stuff anymore. Like, we don't need to do that. Like, we're the time for sort of outreach to those folks, from my point of view, is sort of over. And so I appreciated it for that. I also think it's funny, but I found it that particular comment from Warren to be the kind of thing that I wish Mayor Pete might have said as a member of the community. And instead, I found him completely lacking in, like, emotional connection to this subject matter, which continues to be, like, the bizarrest experience ever to watch, like, the one gay candidate seem like he just read a fact sheet about being gay. I don't know. Maybe we can dig into him a little bit, because I think that, you know, he's the home team in this.
Aww,
I don't feel like he captured my attention the same way that Warren or Booker did.
I'm going to play a little devil's advocate here.
Please.
I think in the same way that Obama had to tiptoe so softly around the issue of race during his campaign, I think that had Mayor Pete come out with a sassy retort to, you know, somebody who said that they were opposed to gay marriage, I think that would have been like the ultimate nail in the coffin of his presidential campaign. I don't think that I've come to appreciate a little bit more, I think, the fine line that he is trying to walk, whether or not that fine line speaks to me as a queer person is another story. You know, like I too would love to see a candidate who would engage a little bit more honestly or emotionally or complexly with their, you know, coming out story, for instance. But I understand why he doesn't do that. The other thing I really wanted to talk to you guys about was Joseph Biden. And what I took to be an incredibly bizarre way of trying to connect with queer people, which is by sort of tiptoeing up to the line of pretending he was queer.
Yeah.
Happened multiple times during his segment. Each candidate got half an hour. He at first was reenacting a moment, you know, he made much of this moment in his past where he said he supported gay marriage before Barack Obama did. And then he went to reenact the moment when he told Obama, you know, I said this thing. And then he goes up to Anderson Cooper. He's like, and then Barack gave me a kiss. And he sort of put his hand on Anderson Cooper's shoulder and acted like he was going to give him a kiss. He also, you know, a good-looking man stepped up to the microphone to ask a question, and Biden goes, wow, he looks like he just stepped out of Gentleman's Quarterly, like, which actually GQ doesn't go by that anymore.
Right.
I didn't even think of that.
Me neither. It took a second. I'm like, Gentleman Quarterly, I would read that. How do I find this publication?
Okay. Yeah, that was an anachronism. And then at another point, he tried to make this joke one time before, but then it really landed later on in his segment where he was like saying that he came out in support of gay marriage. And so he's like, when I came out, and Anderson's sort of like, LOL, that would be news. And then Joe goes over and puts his arm around Anderson and says, yeah, I've got something to tell you. Like, nobody actually thought he was going to come out. But the fact that his way of saying, you know, I'm cool with all this gay stuff was to sort of be like, look, I'm so cool with it, I'll almost pretend to do it myself. Like, look, I have no prejudice against queer people. Like, I'm not grossed out by the idea of touching another man. Seemed so off tone to me. Like he was making a little bit of a gay joke.
Yeah.
Isn't the concept of me, Joe Biden, coming out as gay hilarious? And it felt like somebody was, you know, blasted in from another time period.
I was going to say that's very 90s progressive of him, isn't
it? Yeah.
Because that's how you would portray yourself as being progressive, like 80s and 90s, right? Like, I'm so cool with it.
I'm so cool.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't find other men gross. Look at this. Look, yeah. I'm so cool.
Yeah, and then also when he was telling a story about, like, I think it was his dad, ostensibly first telling him not to be homophobic or whatever.
Right. His big thing was, you know, I've never been homophobic in my entire life because even my dad wasn't homophobic.
And he tells a story about, like, seeing two, and he said this twice, like, well-dressed gentlemen, like, get out of a car. And his dad, I guess, says, you know, oh, they love each other, son. Like, you know, it's fine. But just using well-dressed both times to code gayness was like
as if
they had
modeled for Gentleman's Quarterly.
Indeed, perhaps they came just from a shoot. But it was just this like old fashioned way. Mm-hmm. Like it's well meant. It's not like I'm not like mad about it.
Yeah,
but
he didn't
just
say like limp wristed men.
No,
right.
It's like feels just like, oh gosh, like, you know, grandpa, like stop doing it.
Like you could just say men.
Yeah,
right.
And then
right.
The next part of the story is they kissed each other,
right.
So we could have inferred the rest. That they,
right. Yes.
Right.
We
right.
could have assumed they were well-dressed. Also, I would have loved to hear Pete, like, say something like, hey, you know what, Joe Biden? Not all gay men are well-dressed.
Right.
Like,
respectability politics. That's what I was about to say, is that it's interesting how you often hear respectability politics when talking about, like, you know, people of color, specifically black people, and respectability politics there. But it's interesting to see this kind of creep in with gay people, which I'm like, to be honest, I didn't even realize it was a thing with gay. Like, like, some of the most respectable, well-dressed people that I know are gay, as so are some of the most slovenly dressed people that I know. Like, like there's a gamut there. We all, and you know, surprise, surprise, straight people are also like that, and bi people, and gender nonconforming people. So, like, what is this about being well-dressed? You're not going to take me seriously unless I'm wearing a tie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ugh. I wish we could talk about this for 5 more hours, but we should probably move on. Listeners, please tell us what you thought of this presidential town hall. We would love to hear what you thought about it. I'm so glad that we got to watch it. You can email us at outwardpodcast@slate.com.
All right, on to the next segment. Late last month, Mattel, the famous or infamous toy company behind Barbie, introduced a new line of dolls intended to be gender neutral, the first from a major manufacturer. Called Creatable World, the collection features 6 dolls of varying skin tones and hair textures, and each kit contains different hairstyles of different lengths and clothing options that span the traditional gender spectrum. The executive behind the product told the New York Times that they are meant to, quote, celebrate the positive impact of inclusivity, while a spokesperson for Mattel cautioned that they see them as, quote, something that's all about play and not about politics. We'll see about that. But first, we're joined in the studio by some citizens of the Creatable World.
residents,
yes, of the Creatable World. So I thought we should just start with how we living humans feel about these dolls as toys. Y'all have one. What are you thinking about it?
So, well, I've chosen my doll's bottoms, no pun intended. I was trying to figure out, here, Ricky, why don't you pick the doll's top so that we can have a truly democratically dressed doll? These dolls are so interesting to me. The first thing that I think is pretty exciting and radical as a former lover of Barbie dolls is that it comes with a wig, as you mentioned. So the doll, its hair, our character, should we name our doll, Ricky?
Yes.
What I love about it is that the names on the boxes, like normally they name their dolls like, oh, this is the Ken, this is the Skipper, and these are just like the ED-121.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
their
true.
Their model numbers, yeah.
Yeah, I think that those gender neutral / interplanetary identification numbers that came with the doll are exciting, as is the fact that our doll, who I'm going to call... what's a good gender-neutral name?
Brooklyn or...
Brooklyn.
Yeah, I like Brooklyn because it's very new age, right? We name our
people
kids after...
People after where they're conceived.
Yeah, people after places and things that they do, like Hunter.
Yeah.
And you're like, when did that become a name? Why is Fisher not a...
All right,
Fisher
so
is
little
a name.
Fisher. So Fisher has a head that is mostly shaved all around the side, a.k.a. there's no hair on it except for a couple little, what would you call them, incisions, like razor lines in the back.
Yeah.
And a little, like, mini afro on the top of their head. But then they come with a wig that has very long braids. And I used to spend a long time thinking about cutting my Barbie's hair and then sometimes actually cutting my Barbie's hair. I remember trying to give one of my Barbies layers once I learned what layers were.
Oh.
That was a disaster.
That was so very really Jennifer exciting. Aniston of you.
Oh, my gosh. 100% inspired by Jennifer Aniston. So I was really excited that this doll would have a wig because I think I'll get into this a little bit more later, but I talked to a person who created the gender neutral emojis, and they told me that a lot of times when you're trying to think about what people code as gender, the only thing they look at, you know, in a split second is hair length. And so I think that that was a really good way to signal the fact that this doll could be any gender. But the wig that comes with this doll is, I thought it might be like elastic or something like that. It's a hard helmet with hair on it. It looks like a bike helmet. And I've actually seen people wearing bike helmets like this with like fuzzy little protrusions, which I think takes away from the verisimilitude of the long-haired version of my doll. Brian, what do you think?
Well, this is where I confess that I am, I think, maybe the rare gay guy that did not ever play with dolls,
wow.
as far as I can remember. Yeah, I like...
How did you become gay?
I don't know. I didn't have, you know, whatever, cross-gender, like, toy playing, so that's there's no reason for me to be gay. No, I don't know why. I guess I remember playing just with, like, blocks and stuff. I think I was... Whatever, this is not about me. This is about the doll. The doll is fun. I've never played with one, so this is exciting to
like. You've
be
never
able to
even held a doll, like.
I'm sure I've held one, but I've not like in any intentional way. No, not that I. Maybe my like mom can comment on this, but I don't think so. I've chosen to dress. So mine has I don't know what intergalactic number they are, but. Mine has sort of a side shave, like pompadour thing attached.
That's very like queer, no matter the gender.
Yeah. No, it's totally that. And then I chose to put this very like Texas, like church lady wig on, like, big hair, but blended it with the bangs of like the other piece that's under it, and then gave them a kind of I think like a sort of brunch. Look, it's like fashion sweats and like a camo zip-up jacket.
We have a camo item too. Ours came with camo pants.
Yeah, camo jacket and then some like brown boots and a nice like fedora, you know, cocked to the side. So that sort of look. And it's fun. I like playing with it. I don't know what it's teaching me about gender exactly, but it is fun to put clothes on this small person.
That's the thing. Like, it just feels like a doll with more accessories to me. It doesn't really feel much more than that to me. I too also never really played with dolls. I was a nerd.
Okay, so it makes sense why you're gay.
Yeah.
Dolls are how, like, little, you know, assigned female at birth people get assigned straightness.
Yes. And I never found them very interesting. I did, when I got older, I became a big comic book nerd and I was like into like collectible action figures, which are not dolls.
No, they're
not.
Right,
right.
They're serious business. And I was really into stuff like that. But, like, those are the kind of things that you buy and never take out of the package, right? Like, you're not taking them out and using all the accessories with them. So it just feels like an overly accessorized toy to me. Like, I don't know if there's – I'm going to echo what you said. What is it teaching about – is it teaching anything about gender? And is that its purpose? Like, Mattel seems to think that it's kind of not. Like, it's
Mattel, but they've also been marketing this doll as a way to welcome, like, gender non-binary or gender non-conforming kids into the world of doll play. I'm a little bit more bullish on this doll, I think, than y'all are. I don't necessarily see this doll as, like, foray into our gender neutral or gender queer or gender nonconforming future. But I think it's more of a way to decouple the hyper masculine and hyper feminine characteristics that are normally associated with dolls. So, you know, our doll, like, I guess you don't know what sex or gender the, you know, Fisher is. The people at Time Magazine who got the exclusive on this doll and ran the first big feature on it said, it looks like a 7-year-old child. And I think that says pretty much everything you need to know about the way dolls are normally manufactured, where they have, like, extremely exaggerated secondary sex characteristics. So it's Barbie with her enormous boobs and her, like, big eyes and cheekbones.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Ken with his, like, enormous shoulders and pecs and, like, a small bulge in his crotch area. And it's, like, it's almost like America thinks that if a doll can't fuck, it's not a real doll, you know, and why should kids be playing with it? And so, but this doll, you know, I don't think there's anything about Fisher that says child other than the fact that, you know, they don't have any of these extremely visible secondary sex characteristics. And so I see this as a meaningful step toward just, like, mitigating a little bit of the hyper-genderization of existing dolls, more so than like a gender queering. It's more of like an ungendering.
No, I wanted one question. I wanted to just to piggyback on that for a second. Like, I wanted to ask y'all again as like a person that hasn't played with dolls. Sorry, Christina is the only person.
I'm
that
the
has.
Doll right. correspondent here.
Yeah, like I sort of wanted to just like zoom out really far and be like, what are dolls for? Like
yeah.
philosophically, but I think you're getting at it, which is like for kids. They're probably for all kinds of things, right? They're probably just for fun, for decoration, for, you know, expression. But it seems like once you become an adult, like it's hard not to look at them as these enforcers or constructors of like gender norms.
Yeah.
So in that way, I guess, you know, maybe this is helpful. But I don't know. I don't know if that question is too absurd to ask, but that I was wondering about it.
No, I think that's exactly the question that this doll demands we
yes.
ask.
So my wife is, she's a nanny, and she has been for a very, very long time. And she's been with the same kids for about 10 years.
Oh,
so
wow.
She's been with them since they were about 6 months old. And it's interesting that you bring up the point about, you know, what kids see, especially AFAB kids, what they mm-hmm. see and how they interpret that and how they play with dolls. So there are two older kids that she has that are 10. And when they play like traditional house, right? So one of you has to be the husband and one of you has to be the wife. Until my wife stepped in and was like, you can have two wives. And so sometimes, right. depending on what game they're playing, sometimes it's a husband and a wife, sometimes it's a wife and wife. But the youngest one, who's 8, has already decided that she is going to be a fabulous woman who has no children and mm-hmm. spends all her money. So while the other two older ones are like,
work,
are like, you know, these are my babies and what's your baby's name? And she's just very staunchly like, I'm not having any babies.
I don't
she's
have
like
these babies.
She's shaking
fedora.
A martini.
Yes. Right. Like, so I think that's just to illustrate the point that like when kids can see that as an option, right? Like, I think oftentimes we don't show kids that there is an option to be anything other than this caring, nurturing, you know, mother in training, right? Like, I can distinctly remember that as kids. We're always given baby dolls, right? Those are the things that, quote unquote, girls want to play with. They want to pretend they're a mom. I never wanted to do that. So I think it's interesting to have a toy like this that kind of bucks that norm of like mm-hmm. we're training your child either to be the manliest man or the most motherly mother ever.
And also giving yeah. kids the option to have their dolls change gender expression. Like what I was saying before, I mean, all the clothes that we've been given with Fisher, I think, tend a little bit more flamboyant. I don't want to say necessarily feminine, but definitely not like hyper masculine. Like
yeah.
even the camouflage pants are, wait, let me touch them, are like, you know, skinny pants, like
yeah.
tailored.
Although I'm a fan of this varsity jacket.
Yeah,
to be honest
really
with
cute.
You. I'm like, how can I get this in my size? Will it fit me? No. Okay.
But even the idea that a single person can change gender expression, can look different depending on how their
yeah.
hair is that day, I think is a good way to teach kids that even one person, you know, doesn't have necessarily a stagnant gender expression mm-hmm. or even just way of being in the world.
Or maybe making people more comfortable with the fact that people can look one way one day and another way the next day without you having to like make commentary on it, right? And I think Black women are especially familiar with this within corporate America.
Mm.
You know, you get your hair done one day and you come in and everybody's like, oh my goodness, what did you do? None of your business.
Yeah.
I just, it's the same as just putting on a different, you know, outfit the next day. Why does this have to be commentary? So I think that's also something that shouldn't be missed is this idea that we can change ourselves quickly like that, and it doesn't change who we are as individuals. It's
aww.
Just the thing that we wear and what we feel that particular day.
Well, it sounds like from everything that said that we all want to move to the creatable world. And no, I was prepared to like not be impressed by these, but I think they're great. I think do we all recommend buying them for, you know, the kids in our lives? I think so.
Yeah, they're $30, which I think is a pretty good deal considering all of the clothing options that you get with the doll. And certainly better than most of the other dolls out there, the more hypersexualized ones.
There are some super lesbian shoes, though, in here. Like,
yeah,
these are
got
like
a pair of slip-on Vans.
Yeah, with these
are checkerboard pattern.
So seek out the kit with the super lesbian shoes and enjoy.
All right, now it's time for our gay agenda. Brian, what do we want to send our listeners off with?
So I just was in Houston, Texas for the first time, and I want to call out a specific place there, but also a general a thing that happens, many places that happen there. So there's a bar called Michael's Outpost, great bar name.
It's a great euphemism.
Yeah, and it is like a bar that is in a kind of a strip mall, like between like a Thai restaurant and like a laundromat, like that kind of thing. And it's a old school like piano gay bar, which I think we need to appreciate while we have them around still, because they probably won't be for too much longer. But it's like, you know, red curtains and little lights on the tables and like that kind of thing. But the night that I happened to visit was a drag show called Cabernet Cabaret, amazing name, hosted by Violet Sableau. Think about that drag name for just a second and how great it is. And what I liked about visiting this bar and seeing this particular show was that it reminded me that there are many different kinds of drag performance that are different from, and I'm talking about queening in particular here, that are different from the performance on like RuPaul's Drag Race, which is like death drop, you know, complex look, like super, super loud kind of drag. This drag was much like more old fashioned. The music was actually from all before the 1950s that they chose to do. So sort of like American standard performances, and just like little slip dresses, like just like a quieter kind of drag, and a kind that is a style that I appreciate, where people, the queen, instead of not dancing so much, but just sort of walks around the room collecting tips instead of, performing too overtly. It was just really refreshing to see a different style and again, like an older style of drag put on here and surviving in this little gay bar. So I just wanted to recommend Michael's Outpost in Houston and, go check out different kinds of drag in wherever city you live.
That sounds lovely. Ricky, what do you have for us?
Am I allowed to like repeat something that I said earlier? Because I really would love for people to tune into some of these shows that are that have complex gay characters on them. And I highly recommend, if you like superhero shows, Black Lightning is available on Netflix right now. And I think there are either two or three seasons on there. It's a family of black superheroes. So one, I'm going to recommend that anyway, but also like one of the main characters is gay, and it's not like a storyline, right? It's just who the character is. And I love seeing that on television, where it's not, where you're not an accessory to another cast member, or, your story is not important to tell until that one episode every season where we suddenly are talking about gay issues. It's very refreshing to see that in a show that, in a type of show that typically is very, very gendered and very, like, very heterosexual. And, when they do have gay characters, it's a little bit more overt and, tends to be some sort of, like I said, an accessory for the rest of the show. So check it out, Black Lightning. I love it. And also, she's a lesbian, and I think she's really hot. So
is this a cartoon or a live action?
It's live action, yeah.
Cool.
I can't remember the actress's name who plays her, but it's a little cheesy. Every superhero show is a little cheesy. Yeah. You can't help it. Once you put on an outfit like that, like there's not a way to avoid that. But and then also, like, again, Batwoman is coming out with Ruby Rose, so support our queer characters on television,
saving the world.
Yes.
Yeah.
My gay agenda item is a piece in the New Inquiry titled On Heteropessimism. It's by an author named Indiana Saracen, and the piece gives a name to something that I've thought about a lot over the past year or two. And I think I actually mentioned it on the last episode, this sort of trend of straight people, specifically straight women, sort of lamenting the fact that they're straight or talking about heterosexuality as a prison, trying to performatively reject straight culture while still living as a straight person. So this, I thought, was a really interesting piece, and it explored a lot of different aspects of that phenomenon and effects of that phenomenon and sort of underpinnings of it. The author likens it to white people sharing stuff white people like memes while trying to sort of redeem themselves from whiteness or from heterosexuality by these distancing mechanisms. There's a lot of ways this sort of pops up in contemporary culture. There was that responses to the straight pride parade. The author talks about incel culture, you know, and you know, these quote unquote involuntary celibate men who are saying that heterosexual culture is denying them the sex that they deserve and sort of hating women while also wanting to be with or have sex with women. Ricky looks so disturbed right now. Yeah, it's really fucking disturbing. But in general, it limits the problem of, you know, heterosexuality to men, you know, and not even broadening it out to the idea of misogyny or, you know, heterosexism or homophobia or anything, you know, not institutions that incentivize exploitation or cover up sexual abuse, just the plain fact of heterosexuality. It limits the sort of problems that people are trying to get at when they say, like, oh, screw men, I hate men, but, like, actually I still love men. There's a lot more to the essay than I can explain here, and I highly recommend reading it. I'm still thinking about it. It's called On Heteropessimism by Indiana Saracen.
That sounds fantastic. I think that's about it for this month. Please send us your feedback and topic ideas to outwardpodcast@slate.com or via Facebook, Twitter @SlateOutward. A huge thank you to Ricky for joining us.
Yeah.
It was so fun.
This was awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Thank you. And thank you to Melissa Kaplan, who provided production assistance for this episode. Our producer is Daniel Schrader. June Thomas, the senior managing producer of Slate Podcasts, is aspirational anyway you dress her up. If you like Outward, please subscribe in your podcast app, tell your friends about it, and rate and review the show so others can find it. We'll be back in your feeds on November 20th. Bye, Christina.
Bye, Brian.
Bye,
see you, Ricky.
And bye to our little gender-neutral friends.
Yes, Fisher. Yep.
Bye, Fisher.
Thanks, everybody, and stay gay.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.